The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Welcome to Discover Extra Edition. Stories from Discover, the magazine of science, that we didn't have time for in our regular monthly podcast. I'm your host, Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Episode number 11 of Discover Extra Edition contains five stories covering the Milky Way, human speed, the standard model of physics, fractals, and Listeria. Everything worth knowing about the Milky Way, embraced in spiral arms. The Milky Way is the galaxy we live in, one of the countless collections of stars and dust throughout the universe. It's a reality so basic, grade school kids learn it. But it wasn't always so obvious. Just 100 years ago, the nature of the Milky Way and the universe itself was still a matter of debate. On April 26, 1920, astronomer Harlow Shapley claimed our galaxy was the entire universe. Astronomer Heber Curtis countered that the blurry star clusters seen with a telescope were island universes, separate from, but analogous to, the Milky Way. Within 5 years, Edwin Hubble produced a reliable distance to one of the clusters we now know is our neighbor, the Andromeda Galaxy. His measurements showed that the gulf is so vast, Andromeda must be outside the Milky Way. Upon seeing a note from Hubble describing the results, Shapley said, "Here is the letter that destroyed my universe." He wasn't all wrong, though. In the years since, his prediction that our solar system is far from the Milky Way's center was proven true. Size. For years, the Milky Way's size was relatively easy to remember, about 1,000 light-years thick, 100,000 light-years across. But a 2015 study suggested our galaxy might actually be at least 150,000 light-years wide. That vast area would hold roughly 680 billion times the Sun's mass. Population. The Milky Way has between 100 billion and 400 billion stars, and each star likely has an average of more than one planet, meaning we might have over 400 billion exoplanet neighbors. The name. On a clear night with no light pollution, the Milky Way appears to us as a hazy band of light splashed across the sky. The ancient Greeks thought the phenomenon was from the spraying of divine breast milk when Hera tore a suckling baby Heracles away from her breast. Other cultures had their own name for it, but the Greeks is the one that stuck. Even after learning about other galaxies, the mythological origins remain in the word itself. Galaxias Kyklos literally means Milky Circle in Greek. The neighborhood. The Milky Way, which is 13 billion years old, is among some 50 galaxies in the local group, which itself is part of the local supercluster. Only the Triangulum and Andromeda galaxies are close to ours in size. The rest are much smaller dwarf galaxies. In roughly 4 billion years, the Milky Way will become even bigger. That's because Andromeda, 2.5 million light-years away, is on a collision course with us. The two will combine to become the so-called Milkomeda Galaxy. Everything worth knowing about human speed, born to run. Humans are pretty quick. In 2009, Usain Bolt flew down the track at over 23 miles per hour. In 2014, Dennis Kimetto, the marathon world record holder, cruised along at 12.8 miles per hour. About a 4-minute, 42-second-per-mile pace, for 26.2 miles. Scientists are uncovering what makes the Bolts and Kimettos of the world tick, and how we evolved to do both. That knowledge is redefining what's possible, and may help you speed up too. Muscle fiber types. Muscle fibers come in two general types, fast and slow twitch, and everyone has a mix of both. Fast twitch fibers are for short, powerful bursts. They contract quickly, but also fatigue quickly. Slow twitch fibers have more mitochondria, the cell's powerhouses, that use oxygen to make energy, so they don't fatigue as easily and are ideal for longer activities. As you'd suspect, sprinters have more fast twitch fibers, while endurance athletes have more slow twitch. Although partly genetic, there's some evidence we can train in order to change the proportion of fibers our muscles have. For example, distance running at a slower pace may increase a person's percentage of slow twitch fibers. The anatomy of a runner. Fast factors, sprinting. Everyone takes the same amount of time between steps and the same amount of time to pick up their leg and put it back down again. But faster sprinters propel themselves farther in that time. The difference in speed really comes down to what happens on the ground, says Peter Wyand, a physiologist and biomechanist at Southern Methodist University in Texas. Fast people hit with more force in relation to body weight. Elite sprinters use their legs to essentially throw a punch at the ground, he explains. They get that extra force from their characteristic knee lift. Raising the knee higher gives the leg more space to gain velocity before hitting the ground, so it hits with more force. To sprint faster, Wayans suggests two things. First, try to get the foot that's behind you off the ground faster. As the front foot lands, the back leg's knee should be even with the landing knee. If it's still behind the landing knee, the knee lift in front of the body can be compromised, weakening the punch. Second, try to keep your body stiff when you land. Elite sprinters don't let anything collapse. No floppy ankles, buckling knees, or even head movement, so they don't lose any force as they pop back off the ground again. Fast factors, distance running. To run fast for a long stretch, energy supply is key. If you run faster than your body can supply energy, you'll have to slow down. So the game for the distance runner really is economizing, Wayans says. The faster you can run at a lower rate of energy burn, the better off you are. There are two ways to improve energy supply while maintaining a quick clip. Either produce more energy or burn less. Producing more means increasing something called VO2 max, the maximum amount of oxygen you can take in and turn to energy while exercising. Having a high VO2 max is partly genetic, but also somewhat trainable, especially for new runners. To boost it, run interval workouts. After a warm-up, run hard for 3 to 5 minutes, then jog for 2 to 3 minutes to recover. Repeat about 5 times before a cool-down jog. To burn less energy, you'll need to improve efficiency or running economy. Ways to do this are less fleshed out than the methods of increasing your VO2 max, but Wayne says the typical approach of tapering before a big event, reducing mileage and running faster workouts, can help. But Alex Hutchinson, author of Endure, Mind and Body and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance, says the best thing is simply to run more. However, he acknowledges that most recreational runners are pressed for time and injury-prone. In that case, lessons gleaned from 2-hour marathon attempts may help. Optimizing nutrition, race strategy, and maybe even fancy shoes can help us do the best we can with what we've got. Endurance adaptations. According to a theory made famous by Dennis Bramble and Daniel Lieberman in a 2004 Nature paper, humans are born to run, and run far. There are a bunch of adaptations that have nothing to do with walking, says Lieberman, a human evolutionary biologist at Harvard University. They're just slam-dunk running adaptations. The theory proposes that early humans evolved these adaptations, along with tracking, to chase antelope until the animals collapsed from exhaustion and heat stroke. Winning the foot race meant dinner. Keeping cool. In addition to being furless, we have far more sweat glands than most other mammals, giving us an advantage over fuzzier animals that have to stop and pant to cool down. Baby got back. A large gluteus maximus muscle, a big butt, is a distinctive human feature. We rely on it minimally for walking, but it's crucial to stabilizing us when we run. Springy tendons. Our legs have long tendons, such as the Achilles, that act like springs, helping generate force and reducing the energy cost of running. And they don't seem to provide much benefit to walking, another piece of evidence that our bodies are made for running. Breaking point. In December 2016, with the world marathon record at 2 hours, 2 minutes, and 57 seconds, Nike announced an audacious goal to break the 2-hour barrier. Experts initially balked at the mission, but last May, Eliud Kipchoge, a 2016 Olympic gold medalist marathoner from Kenya, ran 2 hours and 25 seconds, just 1 second per mile off the necessary pace. The sport's governing body doesn't consider Kipchoge's run a world record because it didn't follow the regulations for official records. But physiologists are using it to devise ways to cross the threshold on a record-eligible course. Hutchinson guesses there are a few factors that help Kipchoge. Nike's new shoe technology, engineered for the project, probably shaved off a minute. He shed maybe another minute by drafting, reducing wind resistance by running behind someone else, pacers in this case, and 30 seconds from other things, like the flat course. At last fall's Berlin Marathon, runners had already adopted the drafting strategy. Nike's new shoes, the Zoom Vaporfly Elite, are controversial. The company helped fund the only published study about them. But Hutchinson thinks the evidence is strong enough to suggest they're not just advertising hype. Weyand, also a member of a similar project, Sub2, says efforts go beyond shoes and drafting. Scientists are also working to optimize how much energy runners can extract from fuel sources. It will take perfecting a combination of factors to break the barrier. Everything Worth Knowing, the Standard Model, a theory of mostly everything. The math that describes nature can be simple, even elegant. Consider Einstein's beloved E equals mc squared. A mere 3 letters tell us that matter and energy are essentially the same. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which sets limits on what we can know about reality at small scales, fits neatly on a coffee mug. And then there's the Standard Model. This sprawling equation fills half a page in 12-point type. It's held together by renormalization, the mathematical equivalent of duct tape, and contains a bunch of arbitrary numbers with no pattern, filled in by hand to fit the results of experiments. It's an awkward theory only a physicist could love. But beauty isn't everything. For all its ungainliness, the Standard Model just happens to be the best theory ever devised for answering a question humans have been asking for millennia. What is the universe made of? There's a degree of ugliness to the Standard Model, says Nobel laureate Steven Weinberg, one of its architects. But I think an elegant theory is one which leaves you with a sense that something has been explained, and we've made real progress in explaining nature using the Standard Model. You may have heard that matter is, at its smallest scales, made of tiny dots, electrons and such, called particles. According to the Standard Model, you weren't told the whole truth. Particles are not very interesting, says Weinberg. If you've seen one electron, you've seen them all. Particles arise from something even more fundamental, fields. Fields are invisible and everywhere. You've encountered fields before, the last time you tried to push two magnets together. That uncanny pressure you felt came from magnetic fields pushing back. Fields behave like liquids and can ripple, like the surface of an ocean. When they form a wave, a particle is born. In the 1940s, physicists put the finishing touches on a theory that cast the electromagnetic force as quantum fields, quantum electrodynamics, QED. It suggested that every electron is a ripple in the same electron field, and every particle of light is a ripple in a photon field. Ripples in one field can, like a gust of wind that creates waves in a lake, set off ripples in the other field. Understanding how electron and photon fields play together can explain not only the electromagnetic force and the interaction of charged particles, but also how light interacts with matter. It may sound crazy, but QED has passed every test with flying colors. The creators of the Standard Model extended QED by tacking on fields for other forces: the strong nuclear force, which binds the pieces of an atom's nucleus together, and the weak nuclear force, which describes how atoms fall apart and give off radiation. These fields have their own particles. The Standard Model also added a slew of fields responsible for the particles that actually make up matter, including the quarks that comprise the nuclei of atoms and neutrinos, which barely interact with other matter. The most famous prediction of the Standard Model today may be the existence of the Higgs boson. Have you heard that this particle, first spotted inside the Large Hadron Collider in 2012, gives mass to other particles? You were misled. The Higgs field is the mass giver. It rubs elbows with the fields of particles that have mass, particles of matter as well as the W and Z bosons responsible for the weak nuclear force, but not with fields associated with massless particles, like the photon. For all its successes, though, the Standard Model is not complete. Why the Higgs field gives different particles different masses remains a mystery. The model also has nothing to say about the dark matter and dark energy thought to exist out in the cosmos. Perhaps most strikingly, it leaves out one of nature's four forces entirely: gravity. The Standard Model can't explain how gravity works, or why it's so much weaker than the other three forces. Some researchers have been trying, unsuccessfully, to add even more fields that could solve some of the problems of the Standard Model, an idea called supersymmetry. Others believe that fields may be made of something even more fundamental: tiny vibrating strings. But testing string theory has been problematic. We all agree that there has to be something beyond the Standard Model, but we don't know what that something is, says Weinberg. For now, this ugly theory is the best we have. Everything worth knowing. Fractals. Infinity contained. How long is a country's border? That's the seemingly simple question mathematician Lewis Fry Richardson asked himself more than 75 years ago. The thing that puzzled him was that the length of the measuring stick mattered. Let's use Great Britain as an example. Use a 100-mile ruler and you get one answer for total coastline. But if you reduce that ruler to a mile, it will fit inside bays the larger ruler missed, and the answer will be far longer. An inch-long ruler will give a still larger result. Indeed, Richardson realized, the answer depended entirely on the length of the measuring stick. The shorter it is, the longer the measurement. Taken to its conclusion, the answer was striking. The coastline of Britain is infinite. He didn't know it, but Richardson had just stumbled on a previously unrecognized type of geometric object, one that was destined to revolutionize traditional mathematics. He'd found a fractal. Fractal fabrication. A fractal is like an infinite version of a Russian nesting doll. Zoom in on one, and you get a smaller version, more or less, of what you started with. A coastline is a fractal because at any scale you'll find coves and bays, well, at least until you get down to atoms. In the realm of pure mathematics, though, there are no such practical limitations. Consider, for example, the Koch snowflakes, named after Swedish mathematician Helge von Koch. Start with an equilateral triangle, and then on each side erase the middle third and replace it with a smaller equilateral triangle. Do it again and again, forever. What you get has a similar quality to a real-life coastline, and the more steps you complete in constructing it, the longer the perimeter gets. Do it forever, and you'll end up with an infinitely long border, though all that infinitude still contains a finite area. It's like a mathematical version of a saying by the 13th century poet Rumi. You are the entire ocean in a drop. Snowflakes form fractals in real life, not just in Koch's mathematical imagination. Ice crystallizes around a speck of dust in the atmosphere, and the shape of the water molecules results in six-sided symmetry. The precise atmospheric conditions at each moment of creation determine whether the snowflake will form a branch at each point. Other famous fractal figures. The Mandelbrot set. In 1978, mathematician Robert W. Brooks and Peter Metelsky, in the process of answering a very different mathematical question, defined a new object based on an equation that is, by their standards, quite simple. But the wonders of this object didn't become clear until March 1, 1980, when mathematician Benoit Mandelbrot programmed a computer to draw it. He discovered an object unlike any he'd ever seen. At the largest scale, it's a kind of heart shape with a circular tail. Zoom in, and you'll find worlds within worlds within worlds, with shapes resembling seahorses, galactic whorls, and mandalas. But within each of these fantastical shapes, the original heart-shaped figure also hid. A single equation contained an entire mathematical universe. The Sierpinski Triangle. Here's another you can make yourself. Start with an equilateral triangle and divide it into four equal-sized, smaller equilateral triangles. Then remove the center one. Repeat that process with the three remaining triangles, forever. You'll end up with a Sierpinski triangle, named after Polish mathematician Wacław Franciszek Sierpinski. Amazingly, its area is zero. Interdimensional reality. Fractals often have the rare property of existing between our ordinary dimensions. The Koch snowflake, for example, consists of ordinary one-dimensional lines, but with more and more iterations, it appears fuzzy, as if it had breadth. The Sierpinski triangle is built from an ordinary two-dimensional triangle, but with all the area carved out, it doesn't quite have the heft of two dimensions. Mandelbrot captured this through the idea of a fractional dimension, hence the name fractal. Essentially, it captures how complete and squiggly a fractal is. Think again of a coastline. As you shrink your measuring stick, the apparent length of a craggy coastline will grow much faster than that of a smooth beach, so it will accordingly have a higher fractal dimension. The Koch snowflake has a fractal dimension of about 1.26, and the Sierpinski triangle is a bit higher at 1.58, and the boundary of the Mandelbrot set has fractal dimension of 2, meaning it is as rough a coastline as it could possibly be. It took until 1991 to prove that. Cracking Listeria's secrets. We know a lot about the crafty and resistant microbe, but it remains a deadly threat. One day in August 2011, Penny Hauser spied a bin of fresh cantaloupes at a grocery store in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Mike loves cantaloupe, she thought. While recovering from a grueling bone marrow transplant, her 68-year-old spouse had dropped 30 pounds. Now he was on high-dose corticosteroids and eager to eat. So as Mike enjoyed the melon later that day, Penny inwardly cheered. But weeks later, something was wrong. It was a Saturday night and Mike was watching college football, Penny recalls. I went to bed. By 2 a.m., he still hadn't joined her. She found him on the couch in agony. My head is killing me, he groaned, taking a half-tab of Vicodin. For the rest of the night, the retired podiatrist stared at their bedroom ceiling. The following morning, Mike vomited and felt warm to the touch. Soon he couldn't walk, and then he stopped talking altogether. He landed in the ER, where a spinal tap showed meningitis, inflammation usually caused by an infection. He received intravenous antibiotics and was taken to the ICU. Meanwhile, doctors needed to determine the cause of his illness. They took a sample of Mike's spinal fluid and streaked a few murky drops onto a plate of agar infused with blood. 24 hours later, its ruby surface sported grayish bacterial clumps surrounded by pale yellow halos. Something in Mike's spinal fluid was digesting blood. Further tests revealed it was Listeria monocytogenes, a mysterious microbe whose transmission eluded experts until the 1980s. Listeria's name is a history in itself. In 1924, after an unknown epidemic suddenly felled 6 laboratory rabbits, Cambridge University bacteriologist E.G.D. Murray isolated the killer, calling it Bacterium monocytogenes. 16 years later, physician J.H.H. Peary renamed the bug in honor of Lord Joseph Lister, the first surgeon to routinely sterilize instruments and disinfect wounds. Over a 4-year period in the 19th century, Lister slashed postoperative fatalities from 45% to 15% in a Glasgow trauma ward. He soon became famous. During the 20th century, the more scientists learned about the microbe bearing Lister's name, the more the 19th century surgeon would have marveled. Listeria was ubiquitous, living in soil, streams, rotting vegetation, and the guts of farm animals. It also seemed to thrive in the cold. But its true dangers weren't evident until 1949, when an outbreak in Germany killed scores of infants. Autopsies showed the bacterium in their livers, spleens, lungs, and brains. Listeria also sickened people with weakened immune systems, such as pregnant women and medically fragile adults. By the 1970s, it was no longer surprising to find Listeria in a desperately ill newborn, transplant patient, or chemotherapy patient. But even then, one mystery remained. How did these high-risk hosts catch the bug in the first place? Walter Schleck, then of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, was on the case. In 1981, the young field epidemiologist officer arrived in Nova Scotia to investigate a listeriosis outbreak that eventually claimed 18 lives. Soon after Schleck's arrival, Listeria infected an elderly stroke victim. After trawling the patient's fridge for potential clues, Schleck cultured several foods, eventually finding the bug in an open bag of coleslaw. Bingo! The coleslaw's shredded cabbage came from a Prince Edward Island farm, whose owner fertilized with raw manure from sheep, a source of Listeria. The owner stored his cabbages in a cold shed, a setting guaranteed to spur the bug's growth. Local veterinary records offered one more piece of evidence. 2 years earlier, a couple of the farmer's sheep died of Listeria. In 1983, Schleck published a landmark paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, proposing a mode of transmission that was practically irrefutable. Listeria entered humans through contaminated food. After learning how Listeria spread, epidemiologists investigating outbreaks spent the next few decades identifying a wide array of Listeria-tainted foods, including queso fresco, a Mexican cheese, alfalfa sprouts, chocolate milk, smoked fish, deli meats, even ice cream. In the early 1990s, government regulations helped lower cases of foodborne listeriosis by requiring routine surveillance of food processing sites. But Listeria is still finding its way into new edibles. Since 2010, outbreaks have been linked to fresh produce, chopped celery, chopped and bagged romaine lettuce, and caramel apples. Despite sensitive genetic tools that link cases and solve outbreaks faster than ever, in our modern world of refrigerated and ready-to-eat food, Listeria continues to thrive. That's because, unlike other foodborne baddies like Salmonella, Campylobacter, and toxin-bearing E. coli, it happily blooms in the cold. Even frozen vegetables can harbor the menace. Listeria also loves biofilms, the invisible layers of slime often lurking in processing plants like the one that packed Mike Hauser's melon. That facility's dripping condensation lines, pools of water, and secondhand washers, previously used to clean potatoes, was paradise found for damp-loving Listeria. Though medical scientists have cracked many of Listeria's secrets, the disease continues to harm. In the U.S. alone, 19% of the roughly 1,500 contaminated food-related deaths per year are caused by the bacterium. And Listeria's long incubation from ingestion to illness, measured in weeks to months, hinders early detection of outbreaks. Thanks to our natural host defenses, most of us who consume Listeria never know the difference. Usually our body's immune systems neutralize the invader. But it still lurks pretty much everywhere. Although Listeria is killed by cooking, the bug is hardy, surviving weeks to years in soil and water. So even though we have increasingly sophisticated ways of tracking the microbe, and there are proprietary sprays used in industrial settings that curb its growth, we shouldn't be complacent when it comes to food safety. Nor should government regulators and third-party auditors be complacent when inspecting food processing plants. Just ask Penny Hauser. On February 12, 2012, his 69th birthday, Mike died after months of sickness, unleashed by Listeria, riding the rind of a Colorado melon. That wraps up this episode of Discover Extra Edition. I hope you've enjoyed it and will tune in to another podcast soon. Until then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138.